What is your suggestion regarding reading during the retreat? I suggest don't read and look at the very desire to read, because for most of us, like I used to take a book to the toilet. You can always need some kind of thing to absorb into, and obviously it's not immoral, and reading Dhamma books is good, but just the exercise for during the retreat to fast on reading, it's quite interesting. I like the idea of fasting in terms of internet books, without making any moral judgment about it, but actually to make a deliberate exercise of, okay, I'm not going to read for a week unless it's absolutely necessary. And then I watch the desire to read. And that's very edifying, because you can see the restlessness of wanting to absorb into concepts or whatever. And the restlessness of consciousness seeking an object is a very important thing to understand, because that very movement away from the heart into an object, whatever it be, that very restless movement to objects is a kind of energy of becoming and doing and being, which, again, there's nothing wrong with it. But if we always are and are going outwards into the objective world, then we're preoccupied in a way where the deep silence of the mind cannot become apparent. So even though I might read a really good piece of Dhamma, it might be helpful, and I certainly read, I read the text and so on, to look at that and not do it for a while and just see what happens without making, and maybe it's not a good idea. You know, maybe on fasting, reading actually wasn't such a good idea, but then you know for sure. But if you never try the experiment, then you never quite sure. Like say most, when I was in those early years in Thailand, most of us, we would do like 10-day fasts. We'd do sitter's practice for 2 or 3 weeks. Wouldn't lay down for 2 weeks. We did all kinds of seemingly extreme things. And for some, it was effective. So like, say, my best friend at that time, Anando, we were the same age, and he was from Buffalo. And he would do a 10-day fast and feel absolutely blissed out, radiant, just radiant, because it was a really good purification and cleansing for him. I would do a 10-day fast and feel absolutely miserable. And I found out much, much later that I have a condition that Gilbert syndrome, that if I don't get 1,500 calories of food a day, I get jaundiced. But at the time, maybe we were competitive, I can't remember. But you know, he'd do this 10-day fast and he'd be blissed out. I do this 10-day fast, I'd be absolutely miserable. I thought, oh, my practice is terrible. And I was just sick. So that was the kind of experiment that I, at least I did it. And I, no, that doesn't work for me. That's not really healthy for me. And yet there are people that, but having done the experiment, I did things around sleep. I pushed sleep envelope. That wasn't good for me. But it has kind of given me a confidence of kind of what works for me, what doesn't work for me. So the same with something like reading, whatever. You know, what's the profit in not reading sometimes? Just to watch that. Just to do the experiment. So I'd suggest try not. Just see how it goes. There's so many good books there. It's sort of tempting. Marin, you had something?
Yeah, Sean's put a sign on the table outside for breakfast cleanup. So if people would like to, obviously the people, okay, if you like to just sign up, there's 3 spots for each day. That would be extremely helpful. And then in the kitchen, it's not on there yet, but in the kitchen this morning, Mama said that they would also like to have somebody to do tea time cleanup. So I'll just add a space next to the breakfast cleanup for tea time, and if somebody, I think just one person would be sufficient. So one person each day would do the tea time cleanup, and then it's not my fault or the normal planning.
Okay. We were going to have afternoon sittings outside, but we're not going to do that. Everyone's relieved. We actually left those tents up to see, would it be useful for this monastery to buy a proper marquee that we could use for 6 months of the year, so that if we had a retreat, more people could come in and out. So I just kind of left them up to see, and so this is an indication that at this time of the year, it's a bit too cold. Maybe later in the week. Anyway, so don't worry. I won't put you out there. Marion doesn't do well with cold. So, so yesterday, for those who were, I think Elizabeth and Pushpa, you were back in town and so on, but I was just saying, I'm giving an example of if someone's in the room meditating and they're very noisy, they're very restless and breathing very, very loudly, and one is sitting there trying to focus on one's object of meditation, and the person's movement and breathing and all that become an annoyance, that can give birth to a sense of self. You know, why don't they be quiet, and why don't they sit somewhere else, or maybe I'll sit somewhere else. So then what gets born into consciousness is a sense of self and other. And it's happening all the time, with pleasant or unpleasant. So that's what I was talking about last night. And the teaching which I'm kind of emphasizing is that if one can stay with just the sound of the person being restless, and be attentive to that, that sense of a self being born doesn't have a chance. You don't have any attachment there. So if I can be with the unpleasant, in this case it's unpleasant because I want to concentrate and it's distracting me, and just be with the sound, be with the sound, be with the sound, then no sense of self gets born. So there's just the contact with a sense experience, just the data, we might say. But if I'm heedless, and I'm not attentive to that, then the kind of negative perception of that, because I want to do something else and because this is disturbing me, the mind enters into aversion, which is a kind of attachment, and a sense of self is born. Me, that person. And that pattern is kind of going on all the time in our lives. And to actually recognize that pattern in its various ways of fantasy or positive or negative or anxious or averse or critical or judgmental or hopeful or hopeless, and we have these different moods of mind that come through consciousness, and they're quite natural. There's nothing wrong with hopelessness. It's just terribly unpleasant, but it's very natural. Hopelessness is a very natural condition. Hopeful is a more pleasant kind of condition. So one of the ways to kind of observe this aspect of consciousness, which we call the citta or cittanupassana, the third foundation of mindfulness, or the third area of mindfulness, is to kind of see it maybe like different committee members in your head. And you have all these committee members. There's the quiet one, there's the arrogant one, there's the worried one. Or you could look at it as kind of a drama. You know, the kind of drama going on in consciousness, the different players that come up and play their role. Or you could look at it as weather, in different kinds of weather. But somehow to get some distance on the sense of self, to see it as an object, to see the sense of birth of a psychological self, to see it as an object. And that's the reflective mind. And without the reflective mind, I don't think you can really do Buddhism to any depth. You could certainly believe in it, you could certainly keep the precepts, and you could certainly concentrate the mind into some aspect of quietness. But if you can't reflect and see the objects of mind, the citta, as things that arise and cease, then you can never enter deeply into the silence of the mind. So this is reflection. So when when we talk about refuge in Buddha knowing Dharma, then let's say the committee member that comes up maybe now is one that is judgmental of something in life, in the monastery, in the family, at work, and a kind of judgmental quality comes up. And that's not just a judgmental quality, there's a whole sense of me and other that arises. That's attachment. And then the awakened mind is knowing, oh, this is a type of jitta, or it's a type of weather, or it's a committee member, or it's an actor. This is, oh, there's the judging person, or there's the judger. Now that isn't a judgment of the judger. It's awakening to, well, this is condition that arises when this person, say, let's say someone, let's say you're in charge of the kitchen cleanup, and then you clean it all up, and then you find that someone has left their porridge plate by the lamp, hadn't washed it, and you see it. That's contact, right? And you're in charge of cleaning up the kitchen, and your first thought is, why don't they grow up? You're not mindful at all. And the mind goes into judgment. And just very quick, very quick. I mean, it's a facetious example, but it happens. And then one can maybe feel very self-righteous, and very, very self-righteous. You know? It's not right. I do all the dishes, and they just leave the dishes lying around. That's the birth of a sense of self. And to actually know contact, so you see the dish, and you see the mind react to that dish in a judgmental way, is good mindfulness. Now, one can say at a morning meeting, say, "Come on, you know, we should all be responsible for our dishes," or something like that. That's done. But the sense of self that gets born there, and all it is just data. All it is a visual image, but it's more than that. It's more than that. It's something that I don't want to happen because I'm in charge of the dishes, say. Well, that's an easy example. But if that is not noticed, say, and that becomes a kind of inclination of consciousness, then my mind inclines or is imbalanced, say, towards, say, in this case, judgment. And I see another thing. And the mind is judgmental to that. Another thing, and the mind becomes imbued with a kind of judgmental ego. Well, there's a lot of suffering. And all it is just data. But the mind now is interpreting this data in a judgmental way. It might be about my own character, about the way I perform in life, or about something about my body, or about my thought patterns, or about my emotions, or whatever. That same judging quality then can come up. Oh God, there you go again. You're judging again. You're hopeless. You shouldn't be judging. But it's the same. It's the same sense of self. So what we're trying to do is get out of that belief in a sense of self and see the jitta as jitta. You know, to see judgment as judgment, just that. To see mood as mood, just that. To see emotional weather as just emotional weather. So I would ask you on the retreat to really reflect on what are the kind of stronger actors in your psyche? What are the stronger senses of self that come up? How does self-definition come up for you in a kind of ongoing way? How does self and other get created? Through fear, through self-judgment, through self-disparagement, through fantasy, through hopefulness, whatever. And try to just come back to just the data, just contact. So come back to something simple. So we begin the sitting. I just say, just listen, just sound. That's just data. There's no judgment. It's just the way it is. It's just that. And get that principle down with something which is very simple in the sense realm. Thoughts and moods, they're much more complex. But if you take something simple and get the principle, presence is this way, sound is this way, and you get the sense of the knowing, just the knowing of sound changing. And then as one keeps remembering that very simple principle, then that becomes a power in the mind. And then when the mind goes to judgment, oh, that's just judgment. You begin to see with contact there is this judging going on. In this case, it could be anything. And as one sees that, one says, oh, that's just a type of mood. That's all. It's one of the committee members raising their hand. And you don't have to go there. You don't. You don't have to go there. You don't have to get rid of it either. Because it's just weather. It's just an actor. It's just a drama. It's not who you really are. But it is conditioned and can be very, very powerful. So look in your own mind during the retreat, during your life. The strong. What are the strongest ways in your psyche that self and other get created? How does my sense of a being separate from you get created? How does my sense of a self created within my own frameworks of my body and my emotions and my personal history? How does a sense of self arise? What kind of a sense of self is it? And begin to see that as a mood of the mind, a citta. And then try to notice what triggers that. So if you find that your mind is just obsessing with something, maybe, or just always kind of going to one theme, what triggers that? So maybe I'm obsessing around something resentful that someone has mistreated me. Well, it's true. The mistreatment is not untrue, but what happens is that memory comes up, that's contact, and then there's the feeling, and then there's a thinking in self. It's not right, it's not right. And then from that contact, it's not right, it's not right. Oh, I shouldn't be doing this, I should be meditating. And there's another sense of self. It just goes on and on and on. And to get out of the sense of self, you're just seeing with contact, there is feeling, there's craving, there's an attachment to the craving, there's a birth of self. The Four Noble Truths are based on that. This world is constantly coming and going, arising and ceasing. And you don't have to get rid of it, you just have to recognize it. And that's very important because, I don't know about you, but much of my meditative life has been just kind of getting caught up and then judging my getting caught up. It's like it just goes from one sense of self to another sense of self, and it doesn't really liberate. Whereas liberation is just seeing it's empty. It's just a conditioned phenomenon. There's nothing more to it than that. And you don't have to go there. So look at how you like, even like if you as you're meditating and you find yourself maybe you're meditating and you find after 20 minutes you notice, well, I'm here now. You just got really lost for 20 minutes, let's say, just totally lost in some scenario at home or whatever. And then when you wake up, do you create a sense of self? Do you create a thinker? Do you think, oh gosh, I've been thinking too much? That very perception you want to not believe in. Because then, from that perception, then you try again. Try to be someone who's not thinking. That's a sense of self, right? But if you just notice a sense of self, then you're back just with a date. It's just this way now. And then you can choose an object of meditation. You can be determined, you can focus and all of that. But not from the willfulness of ego, from the willfulness of self. Don't create a thinker. There is thought. See, do that one, like you notice thought, and then notice how you create someone who's thinking. That's an assumption. I know that sounds weird, but look at that. Look at that moment in your practice where you notice that there has been thinking going on, and you create this sense of me, a thinker, I have to stop thinking. Don't do that. Just look, oh, just thought is thought. Just that. Come to the data. It's just thought. It's just perception. Keep coming just to the way things are. Keep letting go of the sense of self. And then the mind begins to open up into the present moment. It's not like I'm trying to become someone who's more mindful in the future. Mindfulness is knowing right now the way things are. And these different actors and committee members and moods and that, very important to understand them and not make a problem out of it, and just know it, just the way it is. So if you feel, if you feel just you hate the retreat, fine. Keep precepts, don't kill me. It's all right. You can hate the retreat, that's fine. If you believe it, you hate the retreat, and then you leave from hatred, well, okay. That's what you carry around, you carry that perception. But if you just see a dislike is this way, and don't create a person around it, it's just dislike, that's all. So begin to include all, like Ajahn Sumedho is very lovely. He wrote us a beautiful email on this Vasa, saying how well he feels and how happy he is, and he's saying he's discovered happiness by including suffering, by embracing suffering. It's a nice way to put it. And the way he quite often talks, he said, it all belongs. Hatred belongs, boredom belongs, it all belongs. And the knowing of boredom or hatred or fascination or inspiration, just to know these are the movements, the different types of weather, takes you to a place which is beyond the weather. It's beyond the committee meeting. You know, it's beyond the sense of self. So it all belongs. So to embrace something negative is hard. You feel lonely, or you feel bored, or it feels like, this isn't working, practice is not working, I don't understand what he's saying, something like that. This is a feeling of not understanding what the heck he's talking about. And you're back. Rather than think you should understand everything, even. But you can know the feeling of being confused, and you don't have to create a sense of self around it. You just come to the data. This is a feeling, this is a jitta of being confused. This is a jitta feeling inspired. This is a jitta feeling I'm not getting anywhere. This is a jitta that, I'm almost there. Or I've made it, or whatever it is. So just a different type of jitta, just a different committee member. And if you practice in that way, then the mind begins to abide in the awareness of change, in the awareness of conditionality, in the awareness of dependent origination. And that abiding is peaceful because it is not dependent on the conditions. It's not dependent on cause and effect. It knows cause and effect. It's a different dimension. Different dimension. All right, so let's do some sitting practice.